So we continue the theme of suffering and its cause, which is a part of the prolonged Eightfold Path series that we will be doing throughout this year. We may have an interrupted series just to break the routine, but for the most part, this will be what we're on. And approach this as if we had never heard about the Four Noble Truths, so that we can really come to a kind of innocence and orientation of inquiry and investigation, which this particular subject needs. Too easily in this tradition, as we hear the talks over and over again, we can say, oh, we can sort of dismiss the content because we've heard it before. As if hearing it before sunk us into the orientation of the message itself, into the experiential truth of what the message is saying. And of course it doesn't. And each time we listen to it fresh and new, perhaps we can come to a different watermark in ourselves of what this particular subject means. And so we have been looking first at the fact that there are multiple ways that we create our own conflict and we create our own difficulty, that we impose a kind of constriction and contraction within our living experience that seems to haunt us in a variety of ways. Most fundamentally, it haunts us as soon as we open our eyes from in the day and we get out of bed with this encased sense of me and the world out there and the work I have to do. It's almost as if we're have an irreconcilable difference between ourself and life, and we've sought the divorce of life, and now we have to put up with the after effects of that divorce. And it's very much like that, because we perpetuate the difficulties and problems and treat life as an abused spouse. So then we had to look at how it is that the mind generates that divisiveness, generates that sense of separation, generates that sense of contraction. And we had to ask whether it was inherent in life itself that we would have this kind of misery. And if the experience themselves of life somehow contained the message of its own difficulty. And we have begun to understand that that's not the case, that life is just a neutral product. It's not for or against us. It's the mind's conditioning to act upon the living experience as either something to embellish or something to disregard. And so we begin to see through the mechanism of fear and desire that there is a way that we create this sense of divorce from life, this sense of separation. In fact, we could say that suffering is the desire for more options than life offers. Because of our memory, because of our recognition, we constantly interpret what could be as opposed to what is. And then we seek the advantage of our mental expression of life rather than the reality that lies before us. And so we often get confused between that, and it's not clear to us what is being offered and what we're conjuring up, is it? It comes so quickly. When I drove my car up to St. Mark's this evening, I was irritated that no one had called from the church to tell me that there was some kind of congregation present that was taking all of our parking spaces. And I was even more irritated when I opened the door and there were a bunch of people I never had seen before. Now, if that isn't self-generated. And so we began to look at how the mind pursues advantageously or in repulsion what life has to offer. And the first way we do that is through the desire for sense pleasures, which we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. And that the need to make our lives comfortable and to seek out what is pleasant, when we have that as our main option in life, then we are inevitably going to be suffering in relationship to the amount of pain and disagreement and unobtainable pleasure that our mind keeps pretending is present but is not in reality. And that leads to frustration, irritation, annoyance, bitterness, cynicism, all sorts of contractions. And today we're going to look at another form of fact of how we recoil from life. And this is the desire for existence. It's the desire for existence. There are three desires, the Buddha said, in which the mind tries to, tires of the way reality puts forth the options and tries to conjure up its own. And one of the ways is in terms of how reality seems to always be deplete in some manner. Doesn't represent the fullness that we expect in our life, the richness, the sense of it being sort of a peak experience, an ongoing peak experience. Sometimes when I look at what we expect compared to what is, it's a little hard to keep a straight face. But this particular desire, this desire for existence, is really a reaction to emptiness. And emptiness is a word that means a lot on a lot of different levels. And it means something in terms of this desire in whatever level we surface in terms of our definition. For instance, sometimes we just feel empty inside, don't we? And that's just not acceptable to us. We feel, in meditation, there's often this point of a kind of a desert feeling, this dark night of the soul, where we have tired of, say, sensual pleasures or the pursuit thereof and are learning that they're not going to pay off in the way we had hoped. And yet there isn't the willingness to release the impulse and grasping when they do arrive. And there's this sense, this symptom of emptiness in the middle of the pleasure. Have you ever noticed that? And that life is essentially dying in front of our eyes. And it can create a kind of hell for us that meditators in particular feel, especially after retreats. They move out. I can remember many occasions in my own life when you move out after a retreat and whatever it was that satisfied you prior to the retreat just feels cold and lifeless afterwards. Your favorite foods, your entertainment, your music, your magazines. And that sense of emptiness feels like the spiritual has abandoned us somehow. That we've done all this work, and now where's the joy? Where is that joy? And that's expectation that life should have a better payoff, especially after we've worked so hard to arrive at a different orientation, is one that can be a long-standing meditation problem. I want to talk a little bit about the meditation problems because I find in my interviews with people who I meet with at home that there are certain categorical ways that people are using in meditation. When I look out here, I don't know how you're using your meditation until I meet you one-on-one. And I don't mean to generalize out, but there are themes that come that, and this is one of them. This sense of emptiness. And now there are deeper levels of emptiness that we recoil at all the time. And we seek existence. We seek some offset to this feeling of desolation that life is often putting in front of us. And the greatest desolation, of course, is the sense of void the sense of quiet, the sense of peace that we'll get to in a little while. That scares us beyond any form of emptiness. But there's a kind of way that we can disembody ourselves as a meditator. And what I mean by that is that meditation can become a way to perpetuate our own agenda and avoid impending painful or fearful developmental tasks that are necessary for spiritual growth. And because if we're not oriented, as the Four Noble Truths teach us, to move into the difficult, and remember the difficult isn't just the painful in the sense of pleasure pain or unpleasant and pleasant, not that, but the way we contract around any experience, the way we hold on to an experience, or the way we push away from an experience. So it's not just difficult means the contracting, the fear, the spirit of wanting something to last longer than it does, or not wanting something to be present at all. But in any case, there can be deep levels of psychic pain in each of us, and we don't sit down in our meditation to experience those psychic pain. That's not what we did this for. We did it for just the opposite, to find relief from that. And so we seek out the corridors of our mind, the caves of our mind, in which we can conjure up, bring out those most subtle and alluring experiences that we long for. And we deny access to those areas that need our real healing. And those are the developmental tasks that many of us have been loath to face in ourselves. In spiritual materialism, a Tibetan teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, put it like this. He said, using spiritual practice to reinforce existing neurotic ego strategies, using spiritual practice to reinforce existing neurotic ego strategies for sealing ourselves off from our actual lives in the pursuit of survival, comfort, continuity, and security. And you can go a long time. We can go a long time unless we're oriented to our meditation in the right direction, seeking continuity of what we're being driven from in our desires for completion, for continuity, for comfort, and avoid the real difficulties that lie back just outside our observable consciousness. And we seal it off. We seal it off. And those things drive us. They will drive us for the rest of our lives. And we can be very sophisticated in our denial of those states. And how we believe or what we believe our meditation should be about. And you'll find that you'll seek teachings that confirm a particular form of pretension in your meditation, rather than to seek the harder teaching of dealing with the problem straightforward. So these Four Noble Truths point us. I mean, it's just amazing to me how the traffic is all going, you know, north to south, and the Buddha is pointing south to north. And it's as if the policeman on the corner is showing you the direction and everybody is just following the other cars blindly. So we have to be very careful about this. It's, you know, the sense of needing to be continuous, this sense of inward continuity, this refusal for this, the sense of emptiness, to have any relationship to emptiness whatsoever. And emptiness is the pain of our own lacking, of our own wanting. We have to be very careful. And I think that's what the Buddha was talking about or was pointing partially towards when he was talking about this desire for existence, this desire for to get over ourselves. because the dead of our desolation doesn't satisfy us, the death of our desolation. And this sense of being driven unconsciously by wanting to escape ourselves, you know, it has, in the desire for existence, it has many forms. There's a, in its most raw form, it's almost a biological urge for existence, isn't it? Our fear of death. As I have mentioned before here, from time to time I wake up at night with sleep apnea. With sleep apnea, and I find myself gasping for air, and the gasp is almost biological. It's not something I can. It's like a near drowning experience, and that sense of panic, biological panic. It's not, you know, it's just the need to exist and to live is remarkable, really. So that's one form this takes, this desire for existence. Another form it takes is in wanting to perpetuate our legacy. And so we try to make things that last, that will outlast us, or will be something that, if we died, could represent that we have lived. When I was in hospice care, I remember one patient who was an avowed atheist. And as I noticed, as people who are avowed anything, well, avowed atheists, begin to approach their death, they begin to look for some sense of themselves continuing, although they can't turn to a God or to a heaven because their philosophies have been against that. But this particular woman, I remember, was sort of groping for her legacy on Earth. And she finally settled with the fact that she would continue to exist in form through her children, and that the way she taught, the values she imparted, her biological systems, you might say, would continue through her children. And that would satisfy the fact of her wanting her need to continue even as she was dying. You see, what is our legacy? What do we try to impart into the earth, into the lives around us that will say something about our continuation? And so that's another form of the way this desire for existence continues. It's also very interesting to see it psychologically. When you're in a conversation and somebody disagrees with you or dismisses you or rejects what you're saying or maybe doesn't validate you as a person, what comes from that is an immediate arising of anger. You see, if you think of it, you have been eliminated. Your existence has been eliminated through your invalidation, through the invalidation the other person is giving. And so, but what is it, what emotion creates the quickest form of your reincarnation is anger. When you're angry, you're in complete form. You're completely validated. You're completely there again. Your existence is confirmed. And so watch what happens when you feel someone is ignoring you or just not paying the attention that you feel you deserve. And watch what emotion comes out to try to reconfirm that your existence has importance. And most often it's anger. The point is the ego survives, wants to survive. And it does it psychologically, it does it biologically, it does it in its legacy. And most of all, it's afraid of its own demise, so it keeps itself going in terms of thinking. And as long as thought is something it can confirm on an ongoing basis, when you sit down, that your thoughts are there, then you can reside comfortably with Descartes that you exist because you think. It's interesting, isn't it? We wonder why, when we really want to be quiet, the mind doesn't shut up. Because the mind doesn't really want to be quiet. And if you look at it, neither do you. It scares us. Silence scares us. I have a friend who's a... He wrote, Gavin Harrison, he wrote the book In the Lap of the Buddha. He has AIDS. And from time to time I've taught with him a death and dying workshop. And I remember in one of the workshops, he was telling the participants, he was telling them how he works with his AIDS. He says, okay, look, AIDS. He talks to it. He says, look, I die, you die. I live, you live. Now, which will it be? And he thinks that he can convince because of that need for continuation, that need. And there are also ways, you know, that we fight our non-existence through our the need to control, the need to be influential, the need to stay on top of something, the need to make our power felt in the world, isn't it? And we don't see this as being a desire for existence necessarily, but that's really what it's about. It's about feeling acknowledged and thereby confirmed. And we do this through, you know, health. We want to perpetuate our health. We want to perpetuate our beauty, our energy, our profitability. We never realized, we never allow life, you know, to die, really. We won't allow it to go through the normal ebbs and flows of its importance and disempowerment. I remember I was setting up a hospice in Central Texas many years ago, and we really had a really nice hospice. I'd set it up, stayed a couple of years, got it so that it was up and running and was serving people, making money, and really had a good future. Then I left, and the administrator who took it over changed everything, and it started to lose money, and the staff started to leave, and it essentially, within the next 2 years, it failed. And I thought, all the energy I put into that, you know, what happened there? Why? I mean, how could I? You know, what went on? Why didn't it last? What was going? And I kept saying, what was the point? What was the point of all of that? The point was that it lasted for 2 years. That was it. That was the point. The point wasn't for it to sustain itself forever. When would have been the point for it to die? You see, from that logic, there would have been no point for it to die. The point is that the child lives with us for however long the child lives, and then the child may die. Our creation, our flesh and blood. And what was the point? I mean, obviously the lost hope, all of that had to do with the sustaining of existence. But life doesn't sustain existence, its existence is. And in the next moment, it is not. And it does, the is not has nothing to do with the is. It doesn't validate or confirm or deny the is whatsoever. The is the is. And it depends on what you mean by is. As to whether you believe that or not. You see, the grasping is life trying to continue itself. The grasping. Instead of just this, the grasping is the future, is the creation of future, is the creation of something more than this, is the perpetuation of this, the continuation of existence. And the mind then continues itself through its grasping. That's how it perpetuates itself. So it can't, because it cannot sustain itself as we know ourselves to be, when it isn't grasping, when it isn't moving itself into the future. That's what it says is life fulfilling. That's how it fulfills its life. See, what happens when we don't do that? What happens when we don't derive the next moment from this one? Then we are left with this moment. And that doesn't sustain anything. It validates nothing. This moment has no validation, no intrinsic validation for anything else. Now you want to feel that? Most of us do not. That's too much of a void. That's too desperate. That's too much of an emptiness. And so then we reach beyond so that we can become, so that the becoming is in the reaching. And the sense of I, the reacher, moves from here into the next and into the next through its need to grasp. And what fills the void? Because nothing fills the void in reality. Nothing can fill the void in reality because reality is void. It's thought that fills it. It's only thought that makes it feel this way. It's only thought that makes that seem like a continuous movement. Because the true story of life is discovered within loss. I wonder how many of us know that. How many of us really understand that? It's in the failed grasp. It's in the ending of. It's in the falling short. From the book Passages by Gail Sheehy, she says, with each transition, some magic must be given up. Some cherished illusion of safety and comfortably familiar sense of self must be cast off to allow for the greater expansion of our own understanding. Within each transition, some magic must be given up, some cherished illusion of safety and comfortably familiar sense of self must be cast off to allow for the greater expansion of our understanding. So it is either we're going to understand reality to a greater extent, or the self is going to confiscate that understanding and hold itself in a contracted position, moving towards the next moment with equal grasping. That's the alternative. It pushes itself forward, or it opens to the understanding of loss, of ended, of things ending, of death. She continues, times of crisis, of disruption, or constructive change are not only predictable but desirable. They mean growth, because the blow of a life accident hits harder if it is coincides with a critical passage in the life cycle, it may force us to resolve the issue of the passage more effectively. Because the blow of a life accident hits harder if it coincides with the critical passage in a life cycle, it may force the resolution of the issue of that passage more effectively. It's like when we're getting old and we're feeling the aging, but we're not really ready to deal with our mortality, and then somebody of equal age dies. That forces the issue and forces the transition and forces the understanding. Rather than the continuation of existence perpetuated by the denial of the mortality. See, that's the job of a habit. The job of the habit is to keep us unconscious, unconsciously protected, in denial. And so it keeps our existence safe, locked up within the thought frames that are necessary for the habit to continue. And may I say, that continuity depends upon our unawareness, our lack of consciousness. And that when we're conscious, when we're willing to move into that passage of being consciously aware, then our understanding will unfold, but not our continuity. Our continuity, it will be what we lose, our sense of continuousness. There are natural gaps in our continuity all day long, but we are very good at covering over those gaps and pretending they're non-existence. There are times in everyone's day when there is a sense of settledness, when you aren't thinking yourself into creation, when there is a space between your thoughts, very natural. Perhaps when you're interested in something and you're giving it full-hearted embrace, and the awareness is full, but your sense of continuity or who you are is vague at those points. Your joy is full, which should give you a sense of what waits when we're willing to give up this grasping need for continuity. But we reclaim ownership of it very quickly. We say, boy, I had a really nice hour doing what I love. We bring it back into the fold of that continuousness. And when we do so, then everything that happens to us is also continuous. Emotions are seen as continuous. Our loneliness. I'm a lonely person. Rather than having loneliness be just what it is. It's non-continuous. All things are non-continuous. But because we can't have a continuous me and leave everything discontinuous, we have to have everything that accompanies the me as also being continuous, so our emotional lives begin to blanket, and we say, I'm an angry person. I'm a lonely person. I'm a depressed person. As if there weren't many more moments in which you weren't lonely, depressed, or angry at all than those moments that you are. But we don't allow that to happen. We don't allow that to be seen. We have to sum up our character and our patterns in accordance with the continuity of our presence. So I am lonely is what we say. It's so interesting. Even after this many years of practice, there can be an emotion and I can see the biting edge of the creative factor that wants to acknowledge existence through the emotion. I see it arise. And then it meets the void and can't sustain itself. Not at this time in me. It cannot go on. It just dies. But I see what I got out of it, what I could perpetuate, and the and the grasping need to do just that. It's there in the moment you see it. And so the life can be filled with the drama of continuation, of struggle, because everything, struggle, problems, challenges, they all must be continuous in order for us to be continuous. And are your lives continuously challenged, continuously disturbed, or problematic, or drama-filled? You see, loss implies something that we are not willing. That's why I say that really the essence of life is contained in the loss. Because it means something. It means the loss of me. It means disappointment. It means that I can't always have pleasure. See, this is what loss means. That's why we don't embrace loss. It means we can't have it our way. It means vulnerability. It means fragility. And the way we make sure that we'll never be touched by loss is that we stay away from the actual experience of life. Because the actual experience of life is a continual sense of loss. And so what we do is conceptualize our living experience. And that way, we stay buffered from the sense of loss which occurs when awareness touches reality, your breath, the true fact of reality. And as long as we can buffer it with our thinking, then we will have a continuousness of our reality. And well, because we're never touching reality, we're touching our thoughts. And thoughts, concepts don't change. Concepts just can sustain themselves. Every time you think of the concept, it sustains itself. You see how this works? You see how difficult, and the reason it's so difficult for you to be mindful in the course of the day? You don't want to be. We don't want to be. Because it means pulling the rug out from our continuity. This is not a small desire. This is a huge one. So we defy the law of life. We won't touch it, really. We won't go there. Because from the concepts, we can breed anything. We can breed the perfect reality conceptually, and we can breed a disdain, a buffer between ourselves and the changing quality of reality. And therefore, we can preserve our differences. Because the concepts can speak to my continuation, to my difference. I can look out and not only see that I'm continuing, but I'm different in my continuation than you are, and judge from there, to bolster my continuation up so that I won't have to feel the pain of my discontinuation. So I seek somebody from the void of nobody. Lily Tomlin. You know Lily Tomlin? In one of her characters, she said, I always wanted to be somebody. I guess I should have been more specific. Because our self-claim, our self-acclaim, is driven by our self-deprivation. To be more than, to continue on, to improve on this thing. To have a chance to get over myself. Reality, in its continuation theme, gives me a chance to get over myself. Gives me a chance to get away from myself. Gives me a chance to better what I feel is the deprived sense of me. And reality just sticks me with myself. It doesn't give me any possibilities other than feeling the pain. Now, what am I going to do when I have the mechanism to create another reality? Why don't I do that? And so we do. And so we do. And so I and life become irreconcilable. I, me, the me within life, those two, me and life, become irreconcilable. Life can never bring contentment, not the way we're driving it. So the divorce is complete. Because of irreconcilable differences, we are now divorced. But who is alive when we stop pursuing the need to be alive? So in meditation, what do? Whatever happens, we do not try to prolong what is happening, nor do we try to shorten the experience of what is happening. We don't try to influence the continuity or the discontinuity of anything. And we're willing to touch it at the fabric, and learn the laws that abide in life, not the ones that we create artificially from our thinking. No prolonging, no shortening. We don't take loneliness and whitewash the sense of me so that I'm always a lonely person. That's ridiculous. Any mood. It lasts as long as it lasts. And we stop protesting the fall, the loss of things. And when we stop protesting the loss of things, we no longer look upon the sense of me as being continuous. And then things do not need to be grasped, because that's the wrong force upon the invitation of the meeting with reality, to invite reality. We can't do that through grasping. So when in meditation, you see, when we're observing from quietude, we're observing from death. From loss, from the absence of. That's what awareness does. It's the state of death. Awareness is the state of death because it has no continuity. Awareness holds no continuity within it. And so to bring forth that awareness of life is to watch life move from death. From that state in which nothing is acclaimed, nothing is grasped, nothing is continued. That's what the meditation does. It arouses, it gives us a different vantage point, it gives us a different orientation so that we can see what life really is. Free from our grasping need for it to exist. And so how do we find immortality then? It's that we allow the silence to be all-consuming. We realize that any noise from stillness is more attempt to perpetuate life rather than live it. And that real life comes from the stillness rather than from the conceptual overlay we keep trying to do to maintain ourselves. And at some point, the heart releases the need to continue itself forth. And we find it, and then awareness finds itself where it has always been and is no longer fooled by the movement in front of its eyes. So let us know the direction our meditation takes, the direction that it points. Let us not pretend to be embodied when we feel disembodied from our life. We have to open our entire life up. All of the pain must be proven to be discontinuous, not meaningfully me, my burden. But the only way we do that is by stepping into the pain. Not because when we are reacting from the pain, we're reacting from the belief of its continual theme, of its existence. The only way we can prove the pain to be non-existent is to step into it. And then we see that what we thought was our childhood drama and all was nothing. It's nothing. But if we are loath to go there, it is because we think it means something about our existence. What could it possibly mean when we aren't willing to exist? Therein lies freedom. And may we all know that. Can we sit for a moment or two? So as we sit, where does the mind reach out? To continue the theme of me. See how quickly it happens? Somebody opens the door and intrudes on our space. A car goes by that has no right to make such noise while we're sitting. All of that grasping has but one point: to keep us existing. So that we don't hear, see, smell, taste, or feel just what is. Just the loss of what is. Any questions at all? I'd be happy to. Yes.
It just occurred to me when you say, when I was sitting, I was thinking about the idea of parent thinking a lot, how difficult that is. Just remembering the way you
think. Right, exactly, yes. You have to be very careful. She was saying that she was thinking about bare attention and how it's very difficult to do, and that what I was talking about is bare attention to nothing. That, no, no. Bare attention is nothing. You don't have to... we're not trying to obliterate.
No, I mean, bare attention without contact.
No. Bare attention by its nature will contact. Bare attention. The void doesn't need to meet the void in order for it to know itself. It just needs to quit the pretension that you live within the forms that arise within bare attention and that you're not bare attention itself. When you know yourself to be bare attention, then the forms arise as they arise and it doesn't disturb you one bit. There's nothing to be disturbed. It's just that we keep taking ourselves to be what arises within bare attention rather than the bare attention. So just if you just quiet, then stillness, you can see, is the given, and everything else comes from stillness. And so everything, you might say, is the child of stillness. It comes up, it has a lifespan, and then it moves back into stillness. And in order to give us life in form, we reach out to other things to give us props so that we can rise up with the other things that are showing themselves in existence. This is getting much too abstract. I want to get down to something more basic here. So, no non-philosophical question. Yes. 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 Yes, yes. The question is that she is in a phase of her life where a lot of people are sick or ill or dying. And up until this point, there hasn't been a lot of that. So that one talk about the passage, the transition now to the reality of loss is being stirred by those around you who are in crisis that force your attention towards that fact, towards that truth. The very importance of emotions are that they're not to be moved beyond at all. That where one is feeling locked or in relationship to the world is often through the emotional message of that, like that all life is despairing, and that has come from the fact that I'm losing people that are very important to me, etc. The message of the emotion must be proved also to be a false part of its arising, the thought around the emotion, the way the thoughts confiscate it and make it into something, some statement of your condition of life or your existence right now, right? And so you can't learn the untruth of an emotion by moving away from it. You have to stay with it, feel it as an experience, which in itself, when not accompanied by an elaborate storyline, only has limited life. But the elaborate storyline keeps boistering the emotion, so that it has more to say about you and your predicament and everything and your storyline than just the experience of it coming and going. So how could you learn that lesson but to stay within the emotion, see where it's misleading you, and watch it die in front of you. Right, right. Yes, yes, exactly. It's exactly right. She says that what seems to be the truth is that the truth is that life is suffering, that it's just miserable, right? And that conclusion, as dismal as it sounds, is actually very life-confirming in terms of you. Because then you've got a whole story about how tragic life is and how it's not worth living, or some angst way of that it'll evolve, you know, that, and a whole setup for yourself to be continually disappointed in life because it's all, you know, you've got a whole book there that's could be written through that chapter of that one conclusion. The book cannot be written. The book has no, all the pages are empty. And you, so every emotion, every feeling, every arising is not a conclusion. It's not a conclusion-based arising. It's just it. Say nothing. And you have friends and people that you are very close to dying. All right? So you move into that reality and you feel the pain of the reality of the depression or the sadness or the grief, the loss. But that isn't any, that's just that. You also have children. So you're also seeing the other side of the equation, even as those people are dying. It can't be written in this thing. See, it's not. See, there's nothing that can create the final conclusion of it. The children can't do it. The people who are dying can't do it. So it's always alive. And regardless of what configuration it takes, it's always alive. It's alive in its depressing configuration. It's alive in its bereavement. It's alive in its birthing. It's alive in the joy of children. It's always alive. Because nothing has been fixed in conclusion to it. And therefore, its joy does not exist within the conditions of how it manifests, but in the living of it itself. Which means in the middle of grief, or disappointment, or loss, or joy, or happiness. Anyone else? Yes.
Things that comfort me when I'm feeling, when I'm in the midst of suffering, you know, and sort of like the, my faith and aliveness, even when there's death and decay in it, you know? It's like I can't even, and I don't know, and I find myself then sort of reverting to corroborating their belief in themselves and, you know, like trying to help them with their fear of losing themselves and dying.
Right. She says that people, a few people around her are dying, but she can't communicate to them her own philosophy, her own understanding, because they're not meditators. And so she finds herself supporting their heavens and their hells and their theologies, their beliefs, the continuation of self. Well, there's a hospice lesson I learned very well in that. When I first got involved in hospice, I really wanted people to die spiritually. And so I would go to the bedside, and I knew I wasn't supposed to bring forth, you know, my understanding to their bedside, but I would wait and not even follow suit. When they wanted to talk about their level of understanding, I was really only interested in the deeper and more meaningful, you know, that there's nobody dying, that kind of. And so I wasn't very helpful. In fact, often I wasn't asked back. rather than focus in on the expression of how it is that they want to see themselves continue or they want to speak, go to the meeting of the person themselves so that you're, instead of driving two cars at one, and, you know, just hold your hand out and meet so that there is a way that it's not about the subject matter, it's about the meeting. And however you get to that meeting, it's a fine meeting. It doesn't have to be through any particular level of spiritual understanding. That you can understand they're afraid, and therefore they need some sense of continuity of themselves. You can understand that they are grieving the loss or the potential loss of everything around them, so you can meet them at that level of despair. And you're willing to do that, and the words don't make any difference what the content of those words are. And it's there that they are reachable and that you can move with them in whatever way they want to move. And it's there they feel met and supported, acknowledged, and most helped. And so we learn that it isn't through the words, really. The words are not meant, if words are meant to support, then they're often cliches that don't do the very thing they intend to do. It's the meeting that supports. And then words that come out of that meeting together are often very supportive.
So maybe that meeting might be more accessible to me if I'm not so obsessed with needing to help or helping.
Or your philosophies.
Yeah.
And the correctness of your philosophies.
Yeah.
And how they would be better off if they just had some Buddhist understanding. Right? We have to be very careful. We have to be very careful in that. I mean, it's we do much more harm than we do support because we're not willing to listen to whatever the person is saying at their level of understanding. Okay. Thank you all tonight very much.